Thinking is one of the things we do best. Wouldn't it be great if we could do it even better? The Philosopher's Toolkit is a set of tools designed with that in mind. Tools for creative conceptualization, for critical analysis, for logical inference, for rational decision, for effective reasoning and rational argument. With those tools, we can be better thinkers, more creative, more logical, more inventive, more rational, sometimes faster, often better at hitting the target. Thinking is what philosophy is all about. In the beginning, all intellectual disciplines counted as philosophy. Philosophy just means love of wisdom, any kind of wisdom, and philosophers were just wise guys. The intellectual history of the West is the history of other disciplines splitting off from that core. First, mathematics, then astronomy, physics, eventually psychology, economics, sociology. I'm Patrick Grimm. I've been teaching critical reasoning for a long time, in addition to advanced logic, philosophy of science, and philosophy of mind. When it comes to thinking skills in general, philosophy is still the core. But the best philosophy has always kept its finger on the pulse of work in other disciplines. The best philosophy has always been intellectually omnivorous. The Philosopher's Toolkit includes tips and examples from statistics, mathematics, psychology, economics, history of science, even a little physics. The course is about thinking in two different but complementary ways. It's about how we do think, but it's also about how we can think better. The first is what philosophers call a descriptive task, a description of how people actually think. The second is what philosophers call a normative task. It's about how we ought to think. In a normative approach to thinking, we're out to evaluate thinking, both good and bad. That leads directly to an attempt to do better thinking ourselves, to develop techniques and strategies for thinking more clearly, thinking with greater focus, more effectively, more efficiently, building stronger and more rational patterns of argument. We don't want to stop with just a picture of how we do think. We want to think better. This is an applied course in better thinking in all of the thinking we do. The aim is to develop a set of conceptual skills useful in all kinds of thinking. You don't need to be a philosopher to use the conceptual tools that we'll be working with. So why do I call it the Philosopher's Toolkit? Part of that's probably just me. I'm a philosopher and I'll be your guide. Part of that is the fact that philosophy is omnivorous. It builds from and includes work from other disciplines. The Philosopher's Toolkit is intended as an inclusive toolkit. It's also the case that the history of Western thought flowers from a central philosophical core. Many of the thinking skills we'll be developing are part of that central core. We'll be returning repeatedly to tips from the great thinkers. Many of those, including not merely Plato and Aristotle, but Galileo and Newton, thought of themselves as philosophers. But it's the normative point that may be the most important. We're out not merely to explore the descriptive question, how people do think, but the normative task, how we can think better. That normative task, both theoretical and applied, the evaluation and development of good thinking, is characteristically philosophical. Philosophical through and through. Let me give you a simple example of both sides of what we'll be doing, the descriptive and the normative. Most of what we do won't depend on numbers. This one calls for a little addition. We've got a bat and a ball. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. Together, they cost $1.10. How much does the ball cost? If you said 10 cents, you've got good company. That's the answer given by about half the university students at Harvard, MIT, and Princeton. That's how people think. That's the descriptive side of the story. But take a minute and really think about it. If the ball costs 10 cents, and the bat costs a dollar more than the ball, then the bat will cost $1.10. But then the bat and the ball together will cost $1.20, not $1.10. You may be smarter than half the students at Harvard and MIT and Princeton. You may have seen that immediately. But even if you did, it's a good bet that the first figure that popped in your head was the figure that occurs to just about everybody, 10 cents. There are two normative lessons to draw from that example. The first lesson is that the intuitive and immediate answers we jump to are often wrong. The second lesson is that it's easy to do better. In this case, all we needed to do was to check on the first answer. 10 cents? No, that won't work. If the ball is 10 cents, the bat has to be $1.10, giving us a total of $1.20. That must be wrong. Let's revise our answer. The correct answer must be 5 cents. Pretty simple, huh? Check your answer. Clearly, half of the students at Harvard, MIT, and Princeton didn't take time to do that. That's what we're after. Not just a report on how we think, but an evaluation of our thinking and a toolkit to make our thinking better. One of the topics that comes up repeatedly in this course is patterns. It's in our nature to think in patterns. That's how we make sense of things. We look for the pattern that underlies them. Let me show you how good you are at seeing patterns in context. Here's an image of a thorn bramble. But there's a bunny in there. Can you see it? Now watch it move. Suddenly, a few of those lines form a bunny as clear as day. But when I stop the image, the bunny disappears. Because of the motion, you see those few scratches as a pattern. They stick out from the context and you can see the bunny. Without the motion, you can't isolate them as a specific pattern any longer, and the bunny disappears. Here's another example. Listen to the following passage. A newspaper is better than a magazine. A seashore is a better place than the street. At first, it's better to run than to walk. It takes some skill, but it's easy to learn, even for young children. It's true that you need lots of room. Beware of rain, it ruins everything. A rock will serve as an anchor. If things break loose from it, however, you won't get a second chance. What could that possibly mean? Does it make any sense? What you're looking for is a picture or a pattern in which all the pieces fit. That's what we're always doing. We're looking for meaning in a series of experiences, looking for the patterns in the world around us, looking for a picture in which all the pieces fit. Did you get it in this case? What that passage is about is kites. A newspaper is better than a magazine. A seashore is a better place than the street. At first, it's better to run than to walk. It takes some skill, but it's easy to learn, even for young children. It's true that you need lots of room. Beware of rain, it ruins everything. A rock will serve as an anchor. If things break loose from it, however, you won't get a second chance. Once you know it's about kites, it all falls into place. What you needed was a picture. Your imagination was much more visual that time around. Our aptitude for patterns is remarkable. We'll be putting that aptitude to conceptual work. But that propensity for patterns also has a downside. We're great at drawing connections. Unfortunately, we're also great at drawing connections that aren't really there. I'm sure something like this has happened to you. You take out the trash and suddenly can't find your car keys. Oh my gosh! Ah, you must have thrown your car keys away. You've just jumped to a causal connection between two events just because they happened close together. We do it all the time, and we often do it wrongly. At a later point, we'll study patterns of fallacious thinking. That's one of them. The Latin name for it is post hoc ergo propter hoc. That means after it, therefore because of it, precisely the fallacy we all tend to make with the car keys. There are plenty of biases built into our thinking. We think in pictures and patterns, and we're extremely liable to be influenced by context. Here's another question for you. You ought to know this one. Quick now. According to the Old Testament, how many animals of each kind did Moses load into the ark? Did you say two? The answer is actually zero, I guess, because it wasn't Moses who loaded animals into the ark. It was Noah. If you caught that slip, good for you. If you didn't, it's not surprising. Loading animals into the ark brings up a vivid picture. We tend to go with the picture, neglecting the fact that something's a bit off in the description. It's also true that Noah and Moses are about the same length, which makes the substitution easier to miss. If I had said, "How many animals of each kind did Methuselah load into the ark?" I'll bet more people would have caught it. And of course, the context is Old Testament, and Moses isn't out of place in that general context. Much of advertising and marketing are made to exploit our conceptual biases. Consider, for example, the pricing in supermarkets. How often have you wondered why the pricing is four for $2 instead of 50 cents each? Researchers have found that the mere suggestion of buying four leads people to buy more than one. In one test, they used 86 different grocery stores and tracked actual consumer purchases, comparing multiple unit pricing, like four for $2, with unit pricing, like 50 cents each. Multiple unit pricing resulted in 32% higher sales. Context can bias your thinking even when you're not aware of it, perhaps especially when you're not aware of it. Here's one of my favorite examples, designed by John Barg, now at Yale. Undergraduates at NYU were assigned a task billed as a test of language comprehension. They were given five words and told to make a sentence out of four of them as quickly as possible. Half of the undergraduates were given a set that contained words associated with stereotypes of the elderly. Florida, knits, courteous, gray, sentimental, bingo. The other half were given words that didn't include those stereotypes. When the experiment was complete, the participants were thanked for their participation. They were told that the elevator was down the hall, and they were then surreptitiously timed. How long does it take them to reach the elevator? Half of them had been contextually primed with words associated with the elderly. Half had not been. Those who had just been doing an exercise involving elderly words walked slower. It took them longer to reach the elevator. It wasn't a huge difference, a little over 8 seconds for one group as opposed to a little over 7 seconds for the other, but results were consistent enough to show the clear impact of context. The reverse effect has been shown as well. When students were asked to walk around a room at the rate of 30 steps per minute, about two-thirds slower than normal, they were quicker to recognize words related to old age, forgetful, old, lonely. Mental context made a physical difference. Physical context made a mental difference. Much of the course is about individual rationality, developing conceptual tools and recognizing and avoiding conceptual traps. But much of it is also about social rationality. In argument and debate, rationality occurs in a social setting. Rationality goes public. In public thinking, there are different traps, but also different possibilities. Argument and debate bring rhetoric along with them. The territory of the course includes rhetoric, both good and bad, debating techniques and how to detect them, rhetorical fallacies and how to diffuse them. It also includes standard tricks used in advertising and in putting a spin on statistics. The Philosopher's Toolkit includes normative tips and techniques for working toward better social rationality. Sometimes we have to dig out of polarization in order to give important topics the open and rational consideration they deserve. Here's the kind of situation we want to avoid. Under Kennedy, in the midst of the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union were negotiating a test ban treaty. On-site inspections were a major verification issue. Each side wanted to be able to check up on whether suspicious seismic activity was just a small earthquake or a detonation in violation of the treaty. How many inspections in the other's territory were to be allowed each year? Both sides went into the negotiations with a number in mind. The United States wanted at least 10 inspections per year. The Soviet Union wanted no more than 3. For days, they argued, 10, 3, 10, 3. Negotiations broke down before anyone had even discussed what inspections were to be like. Negotiations broke down because both sides had committed themselves to a magic number in advance. With the benefit of hindsight, that looks like a case of crippling polarization. How much better it would have been if the conversation could have been shifted away from commitment to magic numbers toward the real concerns, protecting sovereignty and national security on both sides while cutting down on an overkill arms race. There's no guarantee, but with better social rationality, history might have been different. I'm a philosopher, but I've been drawing on results from social psychology. The techniques of psychology are wonderful for the descriptive task, for insights into how we actually do think. The normative question of how we should think goes farther. It demands a typically philosophical approach. Philosophy's been concerned with normative evaluation of thinking from its very beginning. In Plato's dialogue, Socrates talks with all kinds of people in the Athenian marketplace. He talks with Meno the slave boy, and Parmenides the philosopher, Protagoras the sophist, and Gorgias the professor of rhetoric. His typical procedure is to find out what they think about justice, for example, or knowledge or piety, and why. What all the dialogues have in common is that Socrates then challenges that reasoning, probing it, testing it, attempting to show inconsistencies and irrationalities. The dialogues are exercises in the normative evaluation of conventional reasoning. Interestingly, the context is always social. For both Socrates and Plato, rationality is something we work toward together. It is with Plato's student Aristotle that logic begins. In Aristotle, it's clear that the philosopher's task is not merely to figure out how people do think. The philosopher's task is to figure out how to think better, more systematically, more validly, more logically. The enterprise of logic is a major thread in the history of philosophy that runs from the pre-Socratics down to the present day. I've said that in the beginning, all intellectual disciplines counted as philosophy. Other disciplines split off as well-defined topic areas developed recognized techniques of their own. Pythagoras was thought of as a philosopher, and he thought of himself that way. Indeed, Pythagorean thought is an amazing mixture of mysticism, musical theory, and what we think of as mathematics. It's only with formalization and axiomatics in Euclid that mathematics breaks off as a discipline of its own. Astronomy breaks off with Ptolemy's Almagest. If you asked Sir Isaac Newton what his occupation was, he wouldn't have told you he was a physicist. He would have told you he was a natural philosopher. His master work is entitled Philosophia Naturalis Principia Mathematica, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. Physics becomes a recognized discipline in its own right only after Newton and because of his techniques. Psychology as a discipline traces back to William James, professor of philosophy at Harvard. Anthropology developed from what was called philosophy of man. And so it goes. As disciplines split off, philosophy kept track of those intellectual children and grandchildren. That's what philosophy of science is all about, another part of the philosopher's toolkit. The American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce is thought of as the founder of philosophy of science, though he never held an academic position. In an 1877 article, he talks about the fixation of belief. He follows a path laid down centuries earlier by Francis Bacon, evaluating different approaches side by side. How shall we fix our beliefs? The first technique Peirce considers is tenacity. If you have a belief, stick with it. That offers decisiveness, he says, but it cuts you off from new information. Another technique is the method of authority. Believe what Aristotle, or Isaac Newton, or Charles Sanders Peirce believes. That can work for a while, but every thinker is eventually superseded. Only the technique of science, he says, is able to recognize its own fallibility and use that fallibility to its own advantage. Only science, he says, offers a way of constantly testing and criticizing current beliefs in order to work toward better ones. The best philosophy has always been informed by the other disciplines. Indeed, some of the best of 20th century philosophy has been done within other disciplines. Within economics, game theory, decision theory, and computer science, for example. Economists and physicists and social scientists all have tools that should be part of the philosopher's toolkit. In the course of the lectures, I'll occasionally turn to lessons from the great thinkers. There's no chronological order to these. The idea is simply to tie thinking techniques to the history of thought. We can draw lessons from the way Galileo thought, how he designed real experiments, but also how he argumentatively employed mere thought experiments. Pythagoras shows up in Lecture 3. Aristotle plays a major role in several lectures, but we'll talk about Francis Bacon, Pascal, Hobbes, Rousseau, and lots of others as well. The great thinkers roam far beyond traditional philosophy. Einstein's a great thinker that I returned to several times. So are the physicist Richard Feynman and the polymath John von Neumann. Thinking is something you can only understand by doing it. Ours is not just a theoretical exploration of thinking, although there's plenty of that too. Even in the foundational lectures, my emphasis will be on applied philosophy, on putting thinking to work. Each lecture offers a technique of some kind with examples and often interactive challenges. I don't want the philosopher's toolkit to be on display behind glass. I want you to put it to use. We'll talk about graphing the flow of argument and detecting fallacies, for example, but I'll then have you put those tools to use in analyzing and evaluating a staged debate. That means that this is a joint enterprise. We have to do it together. In most lectures, I have something that you have to do. Here's an example. Pay close attention to what's happening in this dialogue.
Hi, Susie. Hi, it seems like ages since I've seen you. Have you been away?
It was a long vacation, but I'm really glad to be back.
Did you actually make it to the Piedmont Inn? And did it look the way it looked when you were there with your parents 15 years ago?
That was really interesting. So the building looked exactly the same as I remembered it as a child, but it seemed so much smaller.
Well, isn't that always the case? I mean, well, children have a very different perspective. Well, I'm glad it was a good trip.
Yes, but it's good to be back to reality. Now, the Smoky Mountains are beautiful, and if you haven't been to the Piedmont Inn, then it's worth the trip.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Bill and I have a little time off coming up. Yeah, so we'll check it out.
You should.
Good.
Did you notice anything change? Depending on how you count, there were four major changes in what you just saw. Here are two of them. The color of the plates changed in the course of the scene. And those coffee cups became wine glasses halfway through. That was a little unfair. I asked you to pay attention to what was happening in the dialogue, and it was what was happening in the background that changed. It's still amazingly hard to see things that you would think should be obvious. This is a demonstration in how we all tend to be change blind. Watch the dialogue again and see if you can find two more changes.
Hi, Susie. Hi, it seems like ages since I've seen you. Have you been away?
It was a long vacation, but I'm really glad to be back.
Did you actually make it to the Piedmont Inn? And did it look the way it looked when you were there with your parents 15 years ago?
That was really interesting. So the building looked exactly the same as I remembered it as a child, but it seemed so much smaller.
Well, isn't that always the case? I mean, well, children have a very different perspective. Well, I'm glad it was a good trip.
Yes, but it's good to be back to reality. Now, the Smoky Mountains are beautiful, and if you haven't been to the Piedmont Inn, then it's worth the trip.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Bill and I have a little time off coming up. Yeah, so we'll check it out.
You should.
Good.
I hope you got those. There's a scarf that mysteriously appears and disappears on one of the participants, and the things on the plates seem to change places. Then, of course, there's that little stuffed animal. Sometimes what I'll ask you to do in the course of a lecture takes more time and thinking than that, something you may want to do with a pencil on paper or the back of an envelope. I'll let you know at the beginning whether a lecture is one that's going to benefit from that kind of work. Skill with any conceptual tool, like with any physical tool, comes with practice. I will want you to apply the take-home lessons of each lecture in the rest of your thinking, outside of the course. These lectures are intended as just a first step in exercising and expanding the way you think. That's where I hope they'll really pay off. There's one button that's particularly useful for this course. It's the pause button. Thinking often takes a little time. I will often suggest a question and propose that you press the pause button in order to think about it. Please do. It's peculiar that our education so often emphasizes timed tests. That has to be for the convenience of the instructor. The pause button is your route to something better, to the careful thinking that we're after, and a response to questions that doesn't have to come immediately. Let's return to the example we started with, the bat and the ball. A bat costs a dollar more than a ball. Together they cost $1.10. How much does the ball cost? That example comes from the work of Shane Frederick, a professor of marketing at Yale. It's used as part of a theory of thinking by Daniel Kahneman, a psychologist who received the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002. Kahneman speaks of two systems in our thinking. System one is fast, intuitive, great for emergencies, and often wrong. When you jump to conclusions, you're using system one. When you first thought about the bat and ball example and 10 cents leapt to mind, you were using system one. System two is slower, more critical, and more systematic. That's where checking your answer comes in. When you do, of course, it becomes obvious that the answer can't be 10 cents. That's system two thinking, as is the further thinking that takes you the right answer. The ball costs 5 cents. It's very much in the spirit of this course that we need to use both systems in their appropriate sphere. In an emergency, a decision may have to be made fast, and our intuition may reflect a great deal of relevant past experience. But in many cases, what's required is careful reflection instead. Much of the philosopher's toolkit falls into that category. Kahneman suggests a technique for emphasizing whichever system is required. I'll let you try it out on your own to see if it works. The technique is this. When what's called for is creative, exploratory, and intuitive thinking, make yourself smile. When what's called for is critical calculation and reflection, make yourself imitate the furrowed brow and puckered lips of concentration. If you put a pencil side to side in your mouth, your face goes into something like a smile. That's the facial posture recommended for creative and intuitive thinking. If you put a pencil sticking straight out of your mouth, your facial posture will be like that recommended for critical calculation. I know, it sounds crazy, but there is some psychological evidence that this link between the physical and the mental actually works. The background theory links it to Barg's elevator test. You remember those undergraduates who had just dealt with words stereotypically associated with the elderly moved different physically. They walked more slowly to the elevator. Students who were forced physically to move slowly were quicker to recognize words associated with the elderly. That's the idea here. Just as concentration does tend to make you frown, frowning can tend to make you concentrate. I'm more confident of almost all the techniques in these lectures than I am of this one. This one's a wild card. But give it a try. See if it works for you. See what you think. How do people think? That's a descriptive question. How can we think better? That question is both normative and applied. Do you want to know both? Both how we think and how we can think better? Welcome to the course. Next time, I'll start off close to where we ended here, with systems 1 and 2. Next time, however, I'll talk about those in terms of rationality and emotion. Cool rationality and hot thought.